Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on WYPR on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman, and Chef Cindy Wolf is not with us today. The program today is on women and wine, and I'm with two female sommeliers, Lindsay Willey and Julie Dalton. And the first segment, we spent a little bit of time just talking about their path to what they're doing and what has made them excited over time. One question I wanted to ask that I did not, and again, this is for both of you all. What is the bottle that you most recently opened that was just the dud, the thing that you had great confidence in, that you thought was going to be in a spectacular moment, that you thought was going to excite the guest, and it never even got past you? Because I know from my own experience that just happens. I'll pull a cork and be like, no, I'm a disaster. This is not in a good mood. I'm going to bring you something different.
And you're talking about something that's correct, but is just in a weird moment.
Yeah, because I mean, that one of the things that guests struggle with often, I think, and it took me a long while, like wine is alive. It's never, the continuum is never perfect, you know. There's always like some weird heart rhythm or something in a wine's evolution. And some things are steady than others in revolution in the cellar. But as time goes by, as seasons change, as the temperature gradually changes in the cellar, as the seasons change outside, as, you know, things show differently. That's, to me, one of the most interesting things.
Absolutely. I mean, you could open two bottles one day after the other, and you know, it's remarkable how different. When we were opening the 99 Mundots a few weeks ago, I was just struck by how every single bottle was so different. None of them were duds, so that's not exactly an answer to your question, but
no, but that
it's
year,
really
the,
remarkable.
The hand bottled everything that year, and that's what happens.
Yeah. So something, it wasn't a recommendation of mine, but you know, I just happened to be opening a bottle of wine that I was excited to try from a producer that I think makes beautiful wines, Giuseppe Cortese in Barbaresco, a 2001 that I thought would be lovely and generous. And the guests had chosen it. And I opened one bottle and really, I think it was slightly flawed. And so pulled another one from the cellar and was just really disappointed in how I guess it was just had kind of gone to sleep for a little bit. The guests really enjoyed it, and I kind of offered it up as if, you know, what do you think about this? Are you happy with it? I'm happy to, you know, pull something else for you. They were excited about it, so I guess it ended up working out well because they chose it and they were happy with it. But I kind of, you know, put the word out, like, maybe it just needs to relax for a little bit.
You needed to relax for a little bit?
The wine needs
maybe
to,
have
like,
a massage.
The wine needs to just chillax for a little bit in the cellar. You know, like you said, because it goes sort of up and down, the evolution of it.
Julie, how about you?
Well, I'm thinking it was one of those situations where I served it anyway because the guest ordered it and it was correct, but it really needed some time. It was Gaia's Brunello di Montalcino, the Santa Restituta. It was 2008. And unfortunately, they ordered it a little bit too far into the progression of their meal for the wine to really open up and say hi. I mean, it was, you know, when you wake up a wine.
Cool, yes, firm vintage, too.
Right, exactly. It just, I don't know, it was pushing its snooze button for a really long time. It wasn't ready to wake up. And I quadruple decanted it, and it still was showing a lot of angles. After about an hour, the guest was like, yeah, okay, this is really coming around. And I said, next time, please call me in advance. This needs probably a day. Another wine, just in general, that I feel like is in sort of a sleepy phase right now are 2010 Red Burgundies. How are they showing for you? Do you agree?
For me, I find it really, really mixed, especially the Côte de Beaune wines are well in advance of the Côte de Nuit wines.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, I mean, one of the things in Burgundy is you have to remember how very, it's funny, the gradations on the hill are one thing, but the north to south, it's very, very, very specific, and the weather patterns all run west to east, so ripening patterns are gigantically different. And
right.
That's one of that's, I mean, there, I opened a 10 Blagny sous les bois that was brilliant and authoritative. I mean, for it, it's a feminine cru, but it's a, it was an authoritative wine, really focused and beautiful fruit, and but from a delicate hand. It was Metro.
Right, sure,
and,
sure.
You know, if you have someone who's like, who makes bruisers, you know, Lemoine or something, and it's Gevrey Chambertin or Von Romanet or something, I think you can put that away until you've traded in your next two cars.
Yeah, that's, I guess, what I was talking about specifically, the Côte de Nuit, because we have, it was a Chambon Musigny, and I'm just like, oh, it needs, no, go back to bed.
Yeah, Chambons are usually the most forward up north, but... But
right.
Yeah, but in a vintage like, in a long ripening vintage like 10, yeah, I mean the little bit of sunshine difference that you have in the south, especially in some of the fatter crus in Pommard and Volnay, I think they'll show up a little bit faster for sure. Volnay especially.
Yeah.
And some of them are starting to show. How about for you ladies? Have you had something that, because in both the cases you talked about, you went ahead and served the wine. Have you opened something that someone really was dying for and you pulled it away, you know, sort of like snatched it out of their hands or took the glass out of their mouths like, no, no, it's not right. You
it's
can't have
ready.
This. Or have you opened a wine and you wonder if it was corked and you were busy and you served it and you thought about it and you thought about it and it made you crazy and you went back to the table and took everything away? I'm only saying this purely from like personal experience and
my
own neuroses.
That's happened before, not recently, but right, where you kind of have, you check it, you taste it, you think it's okay, and then you kind of walk away from the table and you get that little feeling in your stomach when the wine's just not 100% right. And I think it's a tough one to do, but it ends up being so much better in the end, and the guests are so, I find, to be, for the most part, very pleased, and they feel really well taken care of, that you would take the time to, you know, admit that you maybe made a mistake and then, you know,
but you're a sommelier. You're supposed to be infallible, right, Julie? You're supposed to know everything.
It makes you more human.
But you're supposed to be a sommelier. You're not supposed to be human.
I mean, tasting things is, it's one of the most human, you know, one of the most human things you could do. It's not a science. So we are fallible.
So let's take a minute on a few minutes on food and wine pairing, because I think that's, there's an awful lot of the public that's super interested in that. And so I'm curious what pet pairings you have. Let's start with Julie. Three classic pairings you love and three unexpected pairings that you think are brilliant.
Three pet pairings. Champagne and potato chips.
That sounds more like a sofa than a restaurant pairing.
Okay, well, but no.
Sorry to call you out, but.
So, no, get this. Have you guys been to Rose's Luxury yet in D.C.? Or, well, I guess, is it D.C. or Northern Virginia? I think it's D.C. That is D.C.
No.
They serve their caviar with tiny fingerling potato chips, and I had it with Gimonet's Rosé just a couple weeks ago, and it was sublime.
That's
so no little blinis. They were fingerling potato chips and caviar and rosé champagne, and I had died and gone to heaven. It was absolutely perfect.
Not too much tannin in the rosé?
No, not a bit.
So they must cook the potato chips in butter or duck fat or something.
All I know is that they were delicious, and I dream about that pairing. So let's see. I mean, the obvious, Chablis and oysters. Whenever people go straight to the Cabernet page and they're like, yeah, we'll have a shellfish platter and two plates of oysters too. And then the first thing they order is Darius. I will happily open the Darius and bring it to them, but then I will bring them a little glass of Chablis and just try this. Just try this with the oysters. I just want to see what you think, even if they're not interested in white wine with their big red. Another Brunello and lamb chops. Are just, they make, I can't even form a complete sentence thinking about
it. It sounds like a guttural response, but
yeah.
Can you give me any reason why it works so well for you?
Just the lamb chops aren't that fatty, so I don't understand why something as structured as a Brunello is so perfect with it. It must be the old adage, what goes together grows together. Wait, no, land don't live in, wait a second.
No, they don't.
They don't.
Don't. You're thinking about Abruzzo, which is the land of 1 million sheep.
That's yeah, I'm way off. See, it's such a magical thing for me. My brain is just goes out the window. I don't know why it works.
But you know it works.
The gaminess of the lamb and the sanguine qualities of the Brunello is just magical.
That sounds great. That's definitely making me hungry too. Lindsay, how about you? Classic pairings for you?
I mean, I immediately, just because it's winter, I thought I went to oysters too. Raw oysters and good champagne can be amazing, really crisp, clean, bright mineral style, or even, I'm thinking of the Müller-Thurgau that we're working with from Koferhof with the...
And mine's beautiful.
Really beautiful, sweet, slightly briny oysters. I just love that in winter. Honestly, I mean, and then I'm like fast forwarding because it is freezing and thinking of some things in the summer, like when we get really good, red peppers and eggplant and, I love a good pizza. And so sometimes like a really nice, one of the softer styles of Nerello Mascalese from Terranari, just their entry level at Nerosso, and like a good pizza with those stronger kind of roasted vegetables is wonderful. I don't know that's a classic pairing, but it's one that makes me very happy.
Classic for you.
Classic for me.
I love that wine.
Yeah, it's...
Nerello Mascalese and Nerello Cappuccio, it's kind of cool to have something from where it's grown for, since before the Roman Empire. It probably the vine's adapted to that site pretty well now,
Probably.
How about counterintuitive pairings, things that worked for you that you're excited to share that make zero sense?
Well, I think in the winter and in the restaurants where you're, kind of breaking that rule of fish and white wine, I mean, we have, it's nice to work with lists with so much variety that you when people maybe are more inclined to have a glass of red wine, and we offer preparations that are rich enough and ask for that. So, and I think sometimes it's surprising, but works so much nicer and gives them that sort of warming feeling that they're after, on a cold winter night. So that's one that's maybe a little bit atypical. But
how about you, Julie?
I do red wine with fish a lot too, because inevitably you have that table of four that maybe only wants one bottle of wine, and they want half of the table is ordering fish, half of the table is ordering beef. I find that Syrah is the perfect compromise wine. Often people would think that Pinot would be, but I think Syrah, because it's very silky on the palate and it has that smoky, meaty campfire thing on the aromatic and flavor profiles, it really ties into our cuisine because everything is cooked over an open fire. It really ties into the atmosphere. And people are often surprised that I recommend Syrah over Pinot Noir in that instance, because they have this preconceived notion that Syrah is very big. I think the key is having the skin on the fish. The skin sort of absorbs the smoke a little bit more, and it has that nice crunchy texture that and fatty richness from the oils of the fish that really work nicely, bounce off of the tannins of the Syrah. Côte rôtie and rockfish actually work nicely together.
Rockfish has decent flavor. I think you probably have to have, whether it's mushrooms or some kind of caramelized root vegetable business with that to make that work, is my guess. But rockfish has good flavor. It's never surprising. Lindsay was talking about Nerello Mascalese. It's never surprising to me to have some of those really pretty sort of ancient Sicilian or Calabrian reds and have them with fish that's grilled that has good fat, like Bronzino or Orata or something. Those are pretty easy pairings that are somewhat counterintuitive.
And grilled octopus sometimes too.
Octopus you can't have with white wine, I don't think. So now, Julie, you're studying for your master psalm. When you pass, and your brilliance is proven, so what is your celebration wine going to be?
It would be champagne of some sort. I don't know.
The first thing you can probably get your hands on after you pass. The closest bottle of good champagne.
Yeah. I haven't really thought about it, actually. But it would certainly be champagne again and again.
Sounds like the flavor vector that you're chasing is pretty consistent. No question. All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Sure.
Good luck with your exams.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lindsay, thanks for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
Nice to talk with you all. When we come back on Formidable Fun Food and Wine, we'll be talking to Carolyn Sipp. Carolyn is a winemaker working with her father in Alsace in Hunebier at Domaine Sipmach. Domaine Sipmach has been making wines from Alsace varietals, no big surprise, in Alsace for 500 years. She'll be the first, I believe, first female winemaker in that succession. When we come back on Formidable Fun Food and Wine. We'll be right back.